I'd like now to welcome Sylvia Tomashkova. She is a professor of anthropology and women's and gender studies at the University of North Carolina, and she is here visiting the School for Advanced Research. Tonight she will be giving a talk called Wayward Shamans, The Prehistory of an Idea. It's at the New Mexico History Auditorium at 6:30 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a book which is as much really about anthropology and archaeology as it is about shamans. How did this book come to be?
Well, I'm an archaeologist, and I used to work in Eastern Europe, and prehistoric art is an area that I haven't really explored very much, but eventually, just like every archaeologist, I came to be interested in it in terms of who made prehistoric art, and this remains to this day a major puzzle for most archaeologists. In the 1980s and 1980s, an archaeologist from South Africa suggested that prehistoric art wasn't just made by any ordinary person who ever felt compelled to produce art or that they were artists, but rather that it was a part of a much larger ritual, and that these were actually ritual specialists, and he coined the term shamans or shamans. This interpretation gained a lot of popularity, and people suddenly had an idea that they could sort of latch onto and say prehistoric art was produced as a part of a ritual, part of a trance dance, and these shamans were the authors of prehistoric art. And all of a sudden, it wasn't just South African art or prehistoric art or East European prehistoric art, but it was pretty much everywhere around the world, including the Southwest and including North America, Australia. Suddenly, shamans were everywhere. In one of the academic debates, somebody asked the author of this idea, well, where do shamans actually come from? Where does the term come from, and what do we know about the original shamans? And he said, well, I think it's in Siberia, but I don't read Russian, so I'm not the one to do this or to tell you about it. And at that point, I thought, well, I do read Russian, and I know something about Eastern Europe, and I know something about Siberia, so why don't I look into this? And so the book really was my attempt to find and trace the history of shamans to what I thought was a fairly simple, straightforward, going back in time and finding where did shamans come from. And in the process, I discovered that, yes, there were something that we could call shamans, but that also ideas and things we say as anthropologists, but generally things our society says, it depends on the historical context in which that debate takes place. So although I may say that there were shamans at the very beginning in Siberia, they were met by various people over the 18th century, 19th century, or the 20th century, but ultimately there isn't an original shaman, but rather we project our ideas about religion, about mystery, about magic, onto something we called shamans. And so in the book, what I'm trying to do is complicate how we know something about the past and basically warn anthropologists and general audience that when we say we know something, we are coming to it with a whole bag of ideas we actually just project onto it.
Now, the very idea that there would be an original shaman is something that I would even question that. Like, it seems like there's shamans in almost every tribal society around the world.
There are, but this is where I get into a disagreement with people who use the term shaman, because I think that the word shaman does come out of Siberia. And in many societies, that word may indicate something very different. I would say they are religious specialists, or not even religious specialists, I would say they are ritual specialists. And the word shaman is just sort of a label attached to them. And in every society, the ritual specialist does different things, performs different rituals, can be a very different person. In some societies, these ritual specialists can be women. In other societies, they can be only men. In some societies, they can be only old people. In some societies, children are allowed to be if they have a special talent. So there's quite a range. And so to start calling all this bag of different kinds of people shamans, I think doesn't allow for us to explore the richness of that category. And so, in a way, what I'm trying to argue, I would prefer if people didn't use the term.
Is there a common thread among these ritual specialists, as you call them?
I don't think so. I really don't. But I think that this is something that many anthropologists fall into basically two categories. There are people who believe in generalizable, universal ways of being, and then there are people who really believe in cultural specificity. And I fall into the camp of the cultural specificity. I think that every culture has its own ways of doing things, and they may have similarities with other cultures. And then the question just is, are you interested in the details of that cultural specificity, or are you interested in saying, this looks just like whatever they do in Australia? And of course, there are many similarities, and we could focus on the similarities, or we can focus on the differences. But I think that the richness is in the differences.
Now, this whole idea or interpretation about prehistoric cave painting, prehistoric art, that it was made in trance by people who were not just artists who wanted to do something, but people who were actually involved in a kind of ritualistic trance, and that's where the art came from, became, as you said, very popular. I mean, anthropology and archaeology are funny subjects because on the one hand they're very scientific, and on the other hand you can just sort of make something up or say, gee, I think it's this. Like, how do you test that idea?
Well, this is where some archaeologists believe you can connect that idea to neurology, and you can look at look at MRIs or magnetic resonance imaging or at EEGs of people who are in trance, and you can monitor and record their brain waves. And this is where David Lewis Williams connected his just basic interpretation, which is not just made up, but he connects it to neurology and says, if you are in a trance, or if you have, for example, a seizure, an epileptic seizure, or if you go into any kind of drug-induced trance, your brain produces certain wave-like patterns. And he argues that those wave-like patterns appear in many prehistoric paintings. And so whenever there is an image of sort of zigzag patterns or dots or dotted lines, he would argue that that is your brain waves painted onto the wall. And that to him is a proof. It's an interpretive device, and you can be convinced by the argument, and many people are.
That makes absolutely no sense to me.
And many people are not convinced by it because we have no evidence. We say there is a leap between being in trance, seeing the waves, and then painting.
Well, there's a leap between your brain producing waves and you're seeing them as visual.
Have you ever been in trance?
Yes.
Have you had any visual wavy light in front of your eyes?
Rainbows.
There you go. So they are visual.
But they're not the same shape as the brain waves that I'm producing, presumably. I would have to have that proved, seriously.
This is what neurologists argue, that they actually are brain waves that have a visual component to them, that you can record these brain waves, and when you ask the people to describe them, and pretty much even people who suffer from migraines may tell you that when they have the aura, the very severe pain, they can close their eyes and see waves, rainbows, visual geometric patterns in front of their eyes that they can visualize, that it's the brain is producing something that has a visual resonance to it. And therefore, these people who believe that the prehistoric art is made in trance argue that those are the visual cues. If you look at the cave paintings, or if you look at the rock paintings, that you can find these geometric patterns, the dots, whatevers.
We're talking to Silvia Tomaszkova about her book, Wayward Shamans. Now, the subtitle is The Prehistory of an Idea, and as you were saying before, we societies throughout history have kind of projected their ideas about magic and so on onto people called shamans or whatever the local word is. What are some of those projections that people make? What are some of the ones we're making now?
Well, I would start with my historical research. That is, when the German explorers and scientists encountered the Siberian native peoples in the 18th century, they described in great detail what these ritual specialists were doing, because according to them, that was not religion. They had a very specific idea what religion was, in the sense that it had to be organized religion. Christianity, Judaism, or Muslim religions were the only ones that they accepted. And this was not religion, and therefore they described all the rituals in great detail,
and therefore we have all the details. And that was the projection of one idea, that whatever I'm looking at is not religion. It's a ritual, fine, that's it. I also think that we presently have the same idea in the sense that native people are seen as being in greater touch with nature, for example. We have ideas that we project on groups of people in terms of their cultural behaviors, in terms of their belief systems, in terms of what we think they are doing, and then when we start looking at it, lo and behold, some of our expectations are confirmed.
You described a moment ago 19th century academics taking great notes and writing about what they saw. Do you have any way of knowing, or do you have any ideas about whether their projections that this wasn't a religion that they were looking at made them biased? In other words, do you think that there are inaccuracies that were caused in their observations by those biases?
Of course they were. And I think that that is one of the main points that I was trying to make, is that everybody has a bias. That these 18th century German scientists were very scientific about it, but they had biases that were shaped by their educational background, where they came from, how they traveled in what they saw as wilderness. It was an all-male group of scientists who traveled for up to 10 years. And so they had all these biases, which were conscious or subconscious, but they had them. In the 19th century, when the next group came and these were exiles, they had a totally different set of biases. But I would say that there is no such thing as unbiased person who has no preconceived notion of what is it they're looking at. And I think that what is most interesting about archaeology and anthropology is if we spell out beforehand, these are the biases that I am bringing into it, so that if somebody is evaluating my work, they can see whether they think that that bias is affecting my interpretation, or whether they think, well, now that I know what the biases are, I still am convinced by this interpretation. So what I'm trying to argue is that there is no such thing as unbiased research or unbiased interpretation.
So what biases do you bring to your research?
I am very interested in the role of gender in most societies around the world, but gender in relation to power. How do men, women, children, people of all kinds of genders acquire power in their society? And so when I was working on this historical research, I very much wanted to see the degree to which gender and power were linked. Whether if you were more masculine, you were considered more powerful, or the reverse. If you were very feminine, whether you were a man or a woman, but if you were a feminine man, did you have more power? And certain special skills. And that is I recognize it, that's a bias that's in a way my interest I'm looking for. But I have to sort of watch for it, because sometimes it's just not there.
Right. It's interesting that, I mean, people love to see gender difference.
Yes.
Whether or not there is gender difference.
Right.
So what did you find in, just give us some examples, some stories in your research of the kinds of power issues that you saw related to gender in people doing ritual?
Probably the best examples come from the 19th century ethnographies, when these Russian exiles were all the way in eastern Siberia, and so they started working with the native peoples, trying to understand them. And they were socialists who wanted to change society. This is pre-revolutionary, sort of trying to overthrow the monarchy and bring about socialist ideals. They were involved in an attempt to assassinate a czar, so they were exiled. And these were people who really firmly believed in change, in the possibility of change. So when they arrived to Siberia and they encountered men who were ritual specialists, who were dressed as women, behaved like women, there was a linguistic pattern that they used, which was women's way of speaking. And these men would do all this. Some of them would do it for as a lifelong being. And some of them did it literally like they dressed up for the job, performed ritual specialist shaman activities as women, and then went back home and were just regular men. And they described in great detail the possibility to change not just society that they envisioned, but also you could change your gender to be more powerful, to have greater skills, to have greater effect on the society. And this was, for the most part, men who became women in order to perform magic, because they explained that women in this particular context were more powerful. So it didn't really matter whether you occupied a body of a man or a woman. In order to be a powerful ritual specialist, you had to be a woman.
Very interesting. Now, when I hear you talk about that, I wonder if that profession, so to speak, attracted the gay or transgender men of that society.
I think that that is projecting our modern notion of what being gay or what being transgender is, because I think that this was also a society where the same differences between men and women may have lied elsewhere, but also differences between humans and animals were, for example, elsewhere. Many of these people also believed that men could change into women, but also people could change into animals. They could become bears, they could fly as birds, they could become reindeer. And so to say, oh, that's just like gay people in our society, I think is searching for a similarity where there may not be one.
Do you think there weren't gay people in that society, or people attracted to the same sex?
I wouldn't use the word gay, but there were definitely men who lived with men. They were definitely male couples. Some of them even had children, even though when you read the ethnographies in detail, it's unclear where the children came from. But to them, that was not a question. They simply told the ethnographers they had a child and didn't see why that would have been a question. But there were definitely people who were involved in same-sex relations, absolutely.
I would guess that another point of contention that anthropologists have to deal with is the question of what is magic? What does that word mean?
Yes. I think that we tend to, again, imbue that category with all kinds of ideas we have about magic, which is that it's irrational. It is the opposite of science. Whereas I think that in many cultures around the world, but also historically, magic may be an instrumental way of understanding the world, that it is a way to affect the world that gives results, so that might be magic, but also it may be trying to comprehend the incomprehensible, so it allows people to deal with the world where not everything is comprehensible. So, again, I'm a little wary of the word magic because we immediately imagine magicians and people with pointy hats and doing things that we know are kind of silly. Whereas I think in many cultures around the world, magic simply is the equivalent of science. It's a way of understanding the world where you only understand a piece of it and the rest is interpretation, or the rest is something you don't quite understand but you know it works. And that's the way science works.
Right, exactly. And the question of it works,
right,
I think, is really the interesting part, because, I mean, I think any scientist would admit that science changes, and what we think of as, you know, the natural world was once, for example, lightning,
right,
was once thought of as a supernatural phenomenon, and now we realize that it's not. And so there's a continual shift in what's considered rational or irrational.
It is, but also we tend to imbue that with a sense of progressivism, that we used to think it was supernatural, whereas now we know it's physics and chemistry, etc., etc. But an example that I would tell you about is medical anthropology, that now shows that we used to think, for example, when shamans, which were in many societies healers, sort of the equivalent of doctors and that help people to get better, that they would drum and drum and drum and chase the evil spirits out of a body. Many medical anthropologists would tell you that these days, what people believe in drives as much the health outcomes as the medications you give them or as the procedures you do to them. That belief system is just as important, so that whether the drumming shaman drives a spirit away or the drumming shaman takes depression away or makes people heal much faster, we don't quite understand it. So that, to me, is where magic and science overlap. that even in today's world, we have many areas where we are comfortable with the explanation, which doesn't mean it is the explanation.
Silvia Tomashkova is author of the book Wayward Shamans, The Prehistory of an Idea. She will be speaking tonight at the New Mexico History Museum. It's a lecture at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.